One of your earliest experience and the experience of babies in our modern Western world is the experience of wheels. I think by 18 months, they might be able, a baby might be able to point to a wheel. They're definitely given play equipment, play toys with wheels on it. They have matchbox cars with tiny wheels on it. They know if the wheels don't work, the things don't travel as far and it's not as fun, and there's play equipment and stuff like that. So the sort of basic understandings of the shape of a wheel, what wheels do, the names and general importance of the wheel, cultural importance of the wheel, sort of burnt in very early on with other activities like knowing colours, numbers, electricity. That is, you can switch on and off lights, and you can get in a car with wheels. There's that famous song we sing our kids, the wheels on the bus go round and round. But as it happens with education, there's a little bit more to it than the customary knowledge that we pass on. There's a more in-depth knowledge which we have to attain. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. And in this one, I'm going to go into some of the background of wheels as part of a general progression of podcasting to discuss car bits, braking. And with braking, you've got to have a basic understanding of wheels first. And in general, I think this is one of the many things that we sort of skip. And I myself learnt about the velocity and position and things on wheels, or the pneumatic tire inventions and springs and shocks and vibrations and all this type of stuff up at university, when I could have, well, someone could have gently pointed them out to me much earlier at school. I have a richer experience. That's the explanation idea. Part of it, I'm sort of podcasting to develop a sort of a podcast structure into which I can get more efficient rehabilitation while I'm off work with this heart stuff. Not only do you have to increase the ability to podcast and put ideas together, structure ideas. The structure of ideas go into a much larger scale structure. It's a bit like putting tiles down. The small tiles down go into, like jigsaw puzzle pieces, go into a much local area, which go into a much bigger, broader picture. So positioning at the small scale requires an understanding of the big scale. And so through this is with science. There's a lot of small-scale things like the wheel that we have to go back, visit, make sure people understand. Now, there are activities of people bringing wheels, demonstrations and stuff like that, or making wheels, but this is more to just go through some of the aspects or history and development of the wheel. Obviously, people talk about reinventing the wheel, but the wheel has been reinvented many, many times with amazing consequences. So our civilization has got cars with pneumatic tires and wheels are balanced. Sorry for all these noisy parrots and parrots and bird life around at the moment. I learnt in the 1970s, it's one of the little facts which was tucked away, that the Egyptian civilization had no wheels. They built the pyramids using just slave labour, which at that time was slave labour with a big angry boss and been kept, but sort of we now know that it's more a volunteer social come together, let's build society by not invading people, building a pyramid. And we've subsequently discovered other buildings which are built very quickly by thousands of people coming from all over to participate in a nation-building infrastructure project, which I've heard again today. So the British, Egyptians built this, and no doubt they would have had logs or things which rotated underneath these heavy limestone blocks to build the pyramids, to pull them up at ramps. I think there's over 1 million blocks building up the pyramids of Giza. So it was a big project with a sort of fairly stable technology of it, which didn't involve the wheel. And one of the earliest things we learnt was the Sumerian civilization, or the Hittite, I can't quite remember, a civilization which did have wheels, came down and actually smashed the Egyptian civilization, but got absorbed by it at the same time, and so the Egyptian civilization became to have wheels. Then we had the different Greeks and Romans going into the Egyptian civilization, but the civilization was so strong that and so established with a sort of a Nile and temple and religious system that tended to absorb and bits of the culture and add them on. I remember going recently down to a museum here where we did a thing on mummies, doing CAT scans of mummies and looking into it, and eventually seeing the Greco-Roman mummies, which had actually basically a Roman face placed on a mummy's coffin. It was quite amazing to see. So the origin of wheels, when you look into it, merged at different stages. The wheel and axle for transport emerged at various civilizations, from the steppes to the to Europe and areas like this. So there are civilizations which definitely didn't have the wheel, and that would be the oldest culture, continuous culture on Earth, which is our Aboriginal one, the South American ones, various cultures where these heavy rocks were moved about by just obviously Stonehenge was pre-wheel. These heavy rocks were moved about. So the wheel emerged in Europe. I was reading up about just chased up an article on the first picturing of wheels going about 4,000 years ago, which means that the wheels were floating around a lot a little while, just doing the numbers in my head, before they smashed the Egyptian civilization, which means that Egypt was a sort of a self-contained, self-focused civilization. It wasn't sending out feelers to grab new technology and make sure they had it first. They were a bit insular and actually got knocked off by it. But this is the funnel beaker civilization, which is basically they made pots with a funnel top on them for pouring in and out. You can imagine that would mean that water, you wouldn't have to turn at such a big angle for the water or contents to come out. And they had pictures on their pottery of cards, so that'll seal it. But also you've got the thing of any sort of pottery of a particular shape can indicate its origin of a wheel. So that's the origin of wheels. Now the fundamental process of a wheel is, I'll go on the wheel itself, just rotating around, and we'll just assume you have a wheel and an axle. I'll just discuss that. So two wheels or three or four wheels, 3 to 4 wheels creates a stability similar to a stool or a chair. 4 points of contact creates a stability for a platform. So the wheels can be independent axle, or they can have an axle between two of the wheels, which means that the actual force can be a little bit balanced, or you don't have to have balances on both sides to imagine it. And one of the things I want to do is go into one of the most interesting thing is that there is a part of a wheel which, if it has a good life, is always stationary. This part of a wheel which travels with the speed of the vehicle which you ever move, whether it's a shopping trolley or a racing car, that travels either a few kilometres an hour or metres per second, or goes way up to hundreds of kilometres an hour. I think the world speed record of wheels on the ground was set in an Australian lake frame. I think the Thunderbird, I remember the poor old chap died. Oh, look, I think there was an Australian speed record, but then there was also a US land speed record. Good on them, going very fast on wheels. And of course, but what I'm referring to is the fact that a wheel has a complex velocity profile. That is, you've got the velocity of the axis, which is the velocity of the car. The wheel has a radius, which is a rotation. So you add on to that various velocities, and the velocity is omega, the rate of rotation of the speed of the wheel, times r. Omega, if omega is the angular rotation, the number of radians per second produced. So a complete revolution will be 2 pi radians, around 6.23. Off the top of my head, I can't do that. 6.23 thingos times a meter, omega r, will be the velocity of every point relative to the axis at a particular radius. So we have the radius of the wheel, the radius touching the ground. If it's going, so ultimately the speed of the vehicle is equal to omega r as you're going forward, and so omega's in radian. This is another fundamental aspect which is, I suppose, handled differently in physics. We have frequencies, and then we have to add in all these 2 pi's. If you notice, there's a lot of 2 pi's or 4 pi floating in. It's due to the difference of frequency and angular frequency. We've got the axis going forward at V, and then we've got a whole series of points which are added to that velocity. So you've got the vector addition here. So you can imagine this is a bit difficult to teach year 9 and earlier, before vectors, but it's a sort of a vector thing. It's one of these things where the teaching methodology advances, and you really need to go backwards, but also in going backwards you need to prepare. You just can't ignore it, and at the moment it's been ignored. So your point of axis, as far as the wheel is concerned, the bottom of the wheel is travelling backwards at omega r, or the velocity of the car. So if you're in a car, your steering wheel is travelling at 0 kilometres an hour compared to you. You know, it's in the frame of the car. And in the frame of the car, the back of the wheel is spinning backwards at the velocity of the car. So the base of the wheel, the contact point of the wheel, as far as the car is concerned, is travelling backwards at, say, 100 kilometres an hour. And to the external, and the ground is rushing towards us, or towards the occupant, at 100 kilometres an hour. To the observer, they all see the car moving forward at 100 kilometres an hour, and the bottom of the wheel as perfectly stationary as far as the observer. And because what's happened is that you've got the forward speed of the car and the reverse speed of the wheel. So the interesting thing is that no matter how fast you hear a car or see a car going, there's always 4 points of that start car which are perfectly stationary. And then as you go into it, there are 4 points at the start of the car, which is at twice the velocity. That's the top of the wheels, which are going forward. You've got the, if you imagine the axis is throwing the top of the wheel forward. So you've got those, that aspects to it, which is really important because the car has a type of friction called static friction. That is, it's like a cog going in the teeth into mesh. The car deforms and you get a contact potential with the actual a contact adhesion with the road. Now, if you have a system called, and this is why we have to talk about it, if the car skids, you have a heat generation, vibration, and it's called a dynamic friction. So there's obviously sound and energy produced, and the surface is energy on the surface which breaks the contact. Obviously, breaking the contact is lower, so your dynamic friction when the wheels, when the car screeches, is lower. And so you can see this in basic tests where you have a block lifted up on an inclined plane, a slope, and you have a wind it up until it starts going naturally down. You wind it back a few degrees and you get it to go down by just giving a little tap. That is, it's held in static way by a higher degree of friction, but a small little tap will push it into its dynamic regime. So you can do various things. I think it would be quite interesting to do tests. This would be something, if it is generally temperature dependent, to do temperature, you know, whether it's hot or cold. So at some point, you have to have dynamic friction, but the heating up of a surface and the heat building up means that your friction coefficient can be high, when it's static, dynamic, and then it can actually lower it down. It can actually build up, and the vibrations can build up, and so you can actually have the dynamic friction coefficient drop down as heat builds up or things grind away. So that's called a friction fade, and we will have to address that later. So again, that's very hard in with kids, even though people have done physics degrees, that's sort of an instantaneous, obvious thing to see that there's parts of a car which are always stationary, and that could be a quiz question. I don't know whether people would be all that satisfied if you asked it, but then that's a necessary door to go through to establish talking about skidding in such a way. A way that they know. And so what we do is when you brake, there's no force times distance, there's actually no work done. Now, your tyres will heat up when they're on the road, but that's due to deformation heating. So if you get a piece of wire or anything and push it from side to side all the time, it will heat up. So because you're deforming the tyres all the time, it heats up. One of the thing they do in Formula One or those big races, they have a large surface areas of tyres, which must be a nightmare to steer. But that means that you've got a larger area of tyre to wear down, a larger heat build up. Now, to get the heat performance of the tyre correct, in Formula One they have heaters which they put These are the race cars, the heaters which they put on the actual tyres to get the friction there. And I think there's a limit to the amount of aerofoils which you can actually put on a Formula One car, to mean that the faster it goes, the harder it pushes down, the greater the friction. Yeah, definitely. If on the when you're on the grid, people run in and take the cozies off the actual tyre, and you have hot weather tyres, cold weather tyres, wet weather tyres, and you've got all these things to look at, like treads and treads and other and the way the number of basically the way that the actual treads are little connectors pumps to pump through displace so many litres of water as it's going forward. There's a sort of a basic interest to do with it. One of the things I sort of do remember coming home from hospital the very first time and just barely being able to sit in a chair, and I just YouTube Michelin ads, because I had with heart valve going before and after the operation, I had put on so much liquid. I was so absolutely burstingly fat with the liquid. I felt like the Michelin man, so I sort of just love watching Michelin, the old Michelin ads. I do think Michelin, a French tire, if you look at it, invented and made a whole heap of inventions to do with it. So if you've got a hard wheel with a hard surface, you'll get hard vibration. So this is putting a soft air spring. And so amazingly, having our rubber tires are very close to basically a hovercraft. So people from ancient times would look at us and see what we would see in the Back to the Future. I think the Back to the Future was set in 2015. The future was set in 2015. There's hover skateboards, and indeed you can actually build superconducting magnets and superconductor repulsion hoverboards that people have used on, but equivalently our tires, which with the rubber, can actually is almost, we're on a cushion, we're basically driving on a cushion of air. So what we see at the moment is just extraordinary technology, and this is the sort of thing that you have to talk about. I think Michelin invented the radial. This is putting metal inside the rubber to reinforce the tyres, and there's all this thing. Australia used to produce tyres, then we couldn't efficiently do it, and so all our tyres, I think, come from Indonesia or China or Thailand. I can't remember where they come from. Now, the interesting thing is that there's the rubber, but if you just have a tyre in the playground or the garden and you kick it, it's not at all flexible. The actual flexibility of a tyre is due to the air pressure inside it. And if you were to fill it in with an air which wasn't bouncy, the tyre itself also wouldn't be bouncing. So the you are riding on the bounciness of rubber, the stretchiness of rubber, but you're also relying on the actual interatomic elasticity between atomic collisions. I suppose various people, when they get in a car, they feel good about the brand of the car, if it's got a little logo on it, or they love the sound system, or they love the leather, and they imagine different things as they go. But for me, as I'm driving, as I've been driven in a car recently, I haven't been able to drive for the last couple of weeks, you think about the atomic potential, the the bounciness between atoms, which are you're writing, and you're writing on a high pressure version of atoms. Now, I should at this point in time, this is almost a safety thing. I see in dreadful info ads about how you can actually increase the fuel efficiency of your car by overinflating your tyres. Basically, in filming, people basically deflate their tyres and drive along. So rather than actually buy a rail, they can actually do this. And nowadays, you can actually take quite a shuddery film, and it can be digitally unshuddered. And so for that, you have your deflated tyres, and you can actually drive slowly and then speed up your film. It's all these different aspects to get through. Obviously, if you've got clouds or shadows, you'll see the shadows move when you're watching this. But getting back to it, this is whether you overinflate your tyres. Of course, if you overinflate your tyres, you increase the springiness of it. And so if you brake with overinflated tyres and you don't have ABS, which I'm going to talk about later on in another podcast, the car will bounce like a tennis ball or like a bowling ball's another example of dynamic and static friction going in. So this is something which is often advertised in TV as an energy thing, and I dutifully inform the station that this is not. You've just broadcast some dangerous advice, and I always get ignored. But the life has gone on. I have done the best of my ability, warning it, I don't know. It's still a negligent situation, but I've done the best that I can. So there is a you should really inflate your tyres to the level specified by the manufacturer. If you go over it, you'll get a small increase in fuel efficiency. But in conditions where you have to brake quickly, your little car will bounce across the road, or bounce like a tennis ball. So you imagine you're a basketball, you've got to inflate it properly to get everything up into the linear spring coefficient. That is, the actual deformation is energy conserving. So in this case, if you've got uninflated tyres, your tyres will heat up a little bit more. And just as an example, I think there was a often a disturbance in the neighbourhood, and you can go out and see which car has just driven very quickly. Obviously, the heat in the bonnet, but for a substantial way, you can actually look at the heat in the tyres. Just put your infrared bolometer. I've got to find out where I've put mine, and just point it at the tyre and take a reading of it. I'm sure the police do this if they've chasing someone, and they have to actually find out where's the car which has just recently stopped. Oh, look, you can also see the heat dissipation into the road. There's sort of slow motion infrared pictures of snooker and the actual sliding of the ball on the surface of the green felt releases heat, and you can tune this up so you can actually see these paths and heat produced in it. And so that's a general idea. So the discovery of vulcanization. Vulcanization, there's long rubber molecules which are cross-linked with sulfur, which is similar to your when you're eating eggs, the sulfur bonds there cross-link. And so you add sulfur to this sap of a tree, and that eventually cross links. We'll talk really briefly about the weight of wheels. There are an awful lot of wheels out here, and there's things that I think of standardisation and reduction of weight. In Australia, I saw up at the Hawker de Havilland aircraft wing manufacturer. So a lot of the world's wings were, I don't know if they still are, manufactured in Australia. And so this requires these gossamer thin carbon fibre films and resin to be laid on and painted on to these wing surfaces and out the back. So this is a carbon fibre composite wings. So majority of you, if you fly an aircraft, the majority of aircrafts today, its wings, if you look out, they'll look like metal, but indeed they're lighter carbon fibre wings. And in the back rooms, they were producing other carbon fibre tools, I think for another day, and including the wheel. This is the wheel, I suppose the hub is the word for it, in which the actual tire went onto. And so now there's a major, in Geelong, a major carbon fibre wheel production. So it's important in terms of reduction of the weight, overall weight of the car, and the momentum, the rotational momentum of your car. So this is another important thing, is that wheels have there's flywheels, and your car has its momentum, but it's got a little bit of extra rotational momentum, i.e. that when it brakes, the actual wheels have a braking wheel. So if you have a lighter wheel, you get a slightly different feel in your braking. It's a bit lighter. And here we come to, I suppose, an economic thing, that we now have high-tech wheels which can last a very long time, obviously through multiple cars, and increase the efficiency over a long period of time. And we have a model of a car which is built as a unit and then gets scrapped as a unit, where, as I think it's possible down the track for people to rent their wheels. this is down in this amazingly reconfigured car industry. That's just the thought. So we're getting up to an axle. So an axle is basically a rod which is held in bearings, some sort of bearings. People in the old days used to slap on grease onto the bearings. Look, I must admit, there's this entire thing of Cartwright's being able to produce wheels with metal, metal band on the outside, a hot band which is heated up and dropped onto your wooden wheel, and it then contracts and holds the wheels, and these rods that you put in the wheel. And there's a pretty incredible machine. So we're just getting back onto wheels again. Your old pre-rubber wheels, you have these wooden wheels, and there's a pretty amazing lathe which grabs a piece of wood and digs a square hole in it, rotates, you know, in a cammed way, and out of it is just produced a square hole which you put in a square piece of wood, which is your wheel part. You've got the old coaches where the wheels are the actual spokes of the wheel are beautifully, I suppose, turned, but in general, I'm pretty sure that the wheels that you see in the Wild West are square bits of wood and square holes going into it. So you've got all that beautiful structure going into wheels, and this placing of a metal, heated metal ring, which you drop in, is in the production of train wheels. That's another very simple wheel, where the wheel is solidly attached to the axis, and they used to be with a very simple slip bearing. I'm just going on, the actual wheel itself will have a metal ring which is heated up and dropped in on the wheel, and that's sort of high wearing steel, so you can make a fairly cheaper molded not cast iron, but a cast wheel, machine that down a bit and then drop in the precision wheels on the outside to go on tracks. And the entire thing is, it's useful to talk about trains on rails. So trains on rails, obviously, the idea is that your rolling friction is very low. So the wheel is well-defined, radius on a well-defined surface, and the actual rolling friction of steel on steel can be low. So again, the idea is that the train wheel is stationary with respect to the rail. You can definitely hear it, as if it doesn't, you can actually hear the train screech, and this often can be when the trains turn corners. The corner's got a larger radius, the outer rail has a larger radius, and so something has to give, and you'll hear this dreadful squealing. I should point out, while we're at it, the Melbourne trams, I'm sure this is a tram technology throughout the world, has this situation where they sit the metal wheel in a rubber ring and then attach it to the wheel, and it makes the trams whisper quiet, even though it's steel on steel. I don't know whether the actual vibration does travel through to the wheel. And they also have air compression bags which inflate to lift the tram up, so the tram feels as though it's on tram or train. It feels as though it's on floating on a bed of air, but they're actually floating on these little spheres, inflated high pressure spheers to hold them up. So you've got all the aspects of it. Now, I suppose the real invention is that the idea of a rail with a wheel on it is actually being miniaturized and replaced on your axle. So your axle is, you get static friction, you trade off, you model your friction and the way things go. You have now a static friction which you're rolling past, and a dynamic friction of things rolling past in your axle. This is your slip bearing axle. So you can just imagine, if you were, didn't know all that much, you'd just get a rod in a hole and oil the hole. It's a bush bearings, and this can be done for lightweight things. But what we've done is we've actually recreated a loop railway system inside your car, so you're actually running on rails. It's hard to believe it. So a bearing is an outer rail, a wheel, and an inner rail. They're actual metal rails. They're called racers. The wheels can actually be actual wheels. These are rollers with indeed axles on it, or they can be ball bearings. And the ball bearings will rotate. So you can model this by getting a ball and a plank and actually rolling it forward, which is sort of the way back to the way the ancient Egyptians do it. And there'd be a bloke at the front, at the back, grabbing the ball or log, and they'd run right round to the front. And that's exactly what a bearing does, except it's a loop. So the ball runs over in a loop around it. So if you look at a ball bearing actual in action, you'll see outer level, the outer race rotating. If it's of that particular method, if it's the inner which is held and the outer which is rotating, and at, you've guessed it, at half the at half the speed of the rotation will be the bearings going around, and at zero speed will be your inner bearing. You can reverse that through. So this is an important aspect that all of our things in our civilization have ball bearings, and the ball bearings are actually wheels within rails. So we have basically moved those ancient Egyptians actually inside our ball bearings. And so people on skateboards or boards will definitely know the importance of ball bearings, and that though we can actually encase this in grease and seal it in, hermetically seal it, actually weld it closed, so nothing can get in and degrade. Just quickly on the ball bearings. Ball bearings were, I think, discovered accidentally from milling flour, where a piece of metal dropped in, several pieces of metal dropped in, and out came ball bearings. And so what they do, a ball bearing starts off glistening in Germany, the home of the ball bearing, the best ball bearings ever, go in as a piece of square, rectangular, like a little cube. It goes in as a cube in a mill, and there's sort of rough milling and different milling compounds, and the actual reshaping of a cube to a sphere work hardens the outer surface of your ball bearing. Look, I must admit, the best ball bearings I've ever seen is from nuclear reactor ball bearings. These are star sapphire little ball bearings. For some reason, they're required in nuclear reactors and vacuum systems, these beautiful, beautiful ball bearings. The best, they're the best gems I've ever ever seen. So they go in there, and the various grease. And this is another podcast I'll give about the discovery during World War II of molybdenum disulfide. These are the grease in it. So the overall picture, in summary, to get here is that. We start off young, getting customary knowledge of a wheel. That is, we know what it is, we can identify it, we have the concept without sort of a deep scientific understanding of it. And there is this risk that with customary knowledge that we leave this customary knowledge fossilized, and you can exist in a civilization, in modern civilization, without knowing how various things work. So you may exist and think, like, officer, I wasn't travelling, I was speeding. There were parts of my car which were perfectly stationary. There'd be uproar about that, the idea that there's different parts of your car travelling at different speeds. You'd be laughed at a lot of time, but this is some of the basic analysis you need to understand, which gives you... which is part of the foundation between static and dynamic friction, and how cars skid, and how you don't want them to skid. And then further in, a lot of people, because they have their matchbox cars, which don't have a bearing, fail to really understand that cars have ball bearings, and although they... will stand on a train platform and see train wheels go on a rack, on a train rail, they won't necessarily translate that knowledge into understanding how a ball bearing works, and the actual, I suppose, dynamics and heat association with ball bearings, sort of with ball bearings heat and expand and vary their friction down or up as they start to move. And you would know this yourself. If you can just get a ball bearing out of a package and it will be really sticky, and there's sort of working on the viscosity of the of the grease and all that type of stuff. So all that science there, sticking there, and it's up to you to try and introduce this on top of the customary, this is scientific knowledge, or I suppose your analytical knowledge. You've got the customary knowledge, you've got the social knowledge that the people who got the wheel are the conquerors. I've got my wheels, Wheels magazine. There's a whole social meaning to wheels, and there's also the political knowledge about how much is acceptable to know about wheels, and this has probably gone above the amount that is acceptable to know. In the meantime, I'm thinking science. I'm asking you to keep on thinking science and teaching science. Thanks for listening.